You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio.
Yo, I'ma keep it modest, yo, I'm something like a miracle. If I'm being honest, yo, inside I'm feeling terrible. Try to keep it light, give you something that's satirical. Put a whack rapper right into the walls of Jericho. What are you prepared to do? Hunt him like a caribou. See you while you stunting, by you frontin', I ain't hear you. Waiting on reparations, coming and we stare at fools. Run rap circles, wear them out like a pair of shoes. Ooh. Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Dope Knife, and you are listening to Waiting on Reparations. I hope everybody's Labor Day and all that was straight. You know, I hope it was more eventful than mine. Nah, you know what? I take that back. I hope that your Labor Day was more eventful, but as enjoyable as mine. How about that? I did not do a damn thing. I unplugged, and I caught up on some shows that I hadn't watched. I checked out that Boys joint, The Boys. I used to read the comic book back in the day, but I checked that out. And then I also checked out that show Invincible, and that was pretty cool too. So a lot of superhero shit for one weekend, which isn't normally my jam in the slightest bit, but you know, both of those shows were pretty cool. I dug them. It was a cool way to spend a holiday weekend, just vegged out on the couch with the time to actually just relax and do that. So I enjoyed myself. Once again, we are on another week of Mariah being on maternity leave. So let's all wish Mariah well and hopefully she'll get back. There's so many things that I want to talk about with Mariah, especially since I unplugged this weekend and let a lot of things skip me by. I'm just thinking about some of the episodes of stuff that we're going to have to talk about when she gets back. Like, we got to talk about all the crazy shit in Texas. We have to. I mean, that shit is looking like Gilead and shit. They were like, screw it. You can't vote. You can't have abortions. You can't teach about Martin Luther King in school no more. Puppies is illegal in Texas now and shit. It's crazy. So we gotta talk about that. Oh, we also have to talk about Brazil and the Trump official Jason Miller getting detained at the airport after inciting a damn near riot. But in all realness though, they're having, you know, some right-wing pro-Bolsonaro protests. As of today, I don't know what will be going down by the time you guys hear this. And honestly, I want to get Mariah's thoughts on the Kanye West Donda album and the Drake Certified Lover Boy album. In the two albums in juxtaposition or comparison to each other. And just, you know, it's a hip-hop show, and those are the two big event things happening in hip-hop right now that, you know, Mariah's been gone, so we have, you know, I want to discuss that with her when she gets back, even though I really want to rid talking about Kanye on the show, but got to do what we got to do. So, you know, hope when Mariah gets back, we're going to get into those sort of things, but today we have another dope episode for you, and Mariah is going to be with us by way of an interview. She's going to be talking with Dr. Mark Katz, who's a professor at the University of North Carolina and the founder of the State Department program Next Level. I would get all into that, but they're going to cover it all in the interview and more. So you guys stay tuned. We're going to be right back with that after the jump.
So today I'm joined by Professor Mark Katz, author of Build, The Power of Hip-Hop Diplomacy in a Divided World. Based on his experiences as founding director of Next Level, a U.S. State Department-funded program that sends U.S. hip-hop artists abroad to foster cultural exchange, conflict transformation, and entrepreneurship. Professor Katz also teaches courses on music and technology, popular music, and cultural diplomacy at the University of North Carolina. Dr. Katz, thank you so much for being here today. How are you?
I'm good, and thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to be talking with you.
Sweet, me too. To start out, I'm really curious how one just ends up in the business of hip-hop diplomacy, given your background in teaching music and technology. So how did this sort of unfold for you?
Well, it's like a lot of things, it's not a direct path, and I didn't set out to do this, but I had been doing research on hip hop for years. I had written a book about DJing. I studied DJing. I taught classes with hip hop artists. And by the way, I consider myself more of a hip hop scholar than practitioner. I do a little DJing, but I came at this as a scholar and teacher. And I have to give credit to a great musician, a rapper, and singer, and activist, and politician named Pierce Freelon, who told me about this opportunity from the State Department. He found the call for proposals for a project of that came to be known as Next Level. It wasn't called that at the time, but he said, "Hey, Mark, there's this amazing opportunity. We should go for it." And I had been working with him. I was chair of the music department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I'd hired him to co-teach a beat making class. And he saw this opportunity. He said, "Go, you know, this looks a lot like the kinds of things that we're already doing, and in terms of working with the hip hop community and connecting students with practitioners." And he said, "This just looks like an amazing opportunity." So I thought, okay, you know, I'll apply for it. It was this massive application that I had to do in a couple of weeks, but because I didn't learn about it until, you know, a few weeks before the deadline. And amazingly, it came through. And so now I had to figure out how to create a hip hop diplomacy program.
Yeah. And so it kind of built somewhat off of, or you had experience already in working internationally. I think you worked at a youth center in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but more specifically, Pierce Freelon and another artist, a producer named Apple Juice Kid,
yeah,
went there. And I had first taught this beat making class with Apple Juice, and then he started working with Pierce. And then I heard about this opportunity from a colleague to do some work in Congo, and we were able to raise money to send them to Congo. I actually went later. So, but that led to a big series of 2-week workshops around the world called Beatmaking Lab.
Cool, yeah. So did you find there to be a steep learning curve with trying to build out a program for a lot of different cultural and national contexts around the world as a part of Next Level? Or what sorts of experiences were transferable from those beat making workshops into actually working with the State Department?
Well, I would say there was both a steep learning curve and a lot that we were able to transfer, because the steep learning curve part were things that were very specific to working in diplomacy and with the State Department. For one thing, in government, there are millions of acronyms that, you know, you just have to learn what they are, and no one tells you. They just speak in acronyms, and then you have to figure it out. And then it's actually just a culture unto itself, the world of bureaucracy and diplomacy. So there's a lot of learning about what practices are, what the structures are, and all that. So that was a bit steep, but I also knew my way around bureaucracies, having been a chair and being a chair at a, you know, music department at a big university. So I got that part. But the transferable skills were really just the concept of building. And my book is called Build, and that's the
concept.
Yeah, I wanted
concept. To ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a term that I had heard a lot, but then after hearing it for a while, I realized that actually this is a central concept, a central kind of guiding concept and value in the work that I'm doing, which is not so much teaching, not so much bestowing knowledge on others or dropping science, but it's working together, and it's creating something together that you couldn't do alone. And I would say that was probably the most important concept or worldview that I learned from hip hop, and I credit hip hop with teaching me that, because I've been a teacher for many years, and the model is, you know, the teacher has all the information and gives it to the students. And I can't say I was one of those types that just stood up and lectured all the time. I always preferred a collaborative approach. But when I would hear people talking about building and saying, you know, I don't want these Americans coming into Zimbabwe and teaching us hip hop. I want to build with them. Yeah. That really clarified for me what hip hop diplomacy is about. It's about Americans, U.S. citizens, building collaboratively with hip hop artists around the world.
Yeah, and so I was curious if this concept of building that is very central to hip hop, y'all, let's link, let's build, let's collab, if there's an analog, if you found there to be an analog in other cultural contexts where you all are working, where they have the similar ethos of like, yo, let's link, let's build, you know, and yeah.
Well, I mean, there are concepts like that in a lot of cultures, but the interesting thing is that people use the specific English word build.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it is, you know, that's the word that they used in Zimbabwe. That's a word I heard in Myanmar. It's a word, I mean, I've heard it all over the world. And it's funny just on that point about hip hop slang or language, you know, I would say, like, what do you call an argument, you know, that people in hip hop have? And they say, well, it's a beef, you know, mm-hmm. like they would use the word, the English word beef, even though it was, you know, it was not their language. So it was always kind of surprising to me how the language and ethos of hip hop has spread around the world. But I will say it's not a kind of colonizing or imperialistic spread. It's more like concepts that are native to hip hop connected with concepts that were native in other countries and just found a connection. So one thing that I always felt going to other countries, I could be in a place, and most of the time I was in a place I'd never been before, was that the connection between the artists coming from the US and the artists in the country visited was more like not a diplomatic delegation of country, of, you know, men in suits and meeting each other for the first time, but more like a family reunion where you meet cousins for the first time. You've never met them, but they're family. So there's an automatic kind of connection. That's how it felt to me.
Awesome. It sounds amazing. But you did mention imperialism, and I wanted to ask some about, you know, artists, particularly, you know, within hip hop, there is a very anti-authoritarian stance. Oftentimes there is, you know, critique of the government. And some artists had some qualms or, you know, dealt internally with some questions about how they felt about going abroad and, you know, working with the State Department. So could you talk some about how artists grappled with their distrust of the U.S. government or their embrace of the opportunity of travel, and how those questions of, you know, being a part of the state apparatus in a certain way was dealt with by various people you worked with?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question I basically ask every single person, every hip hop artist that I worked with, because I was curious about it, and I wanted to know what would make them feel comfortable with the idea of working with the government. And I got a lot of different answers, but basically what it comes down to is the idea of agency and autonomy. Could the artist honor, or could the project honor the agency of the individual artist and let them act as the artists they want to be? Did they have the autonomy to say what they want, to build in the way they want? And if the answer is yes, then like, okay, I can work with these people because they're allowing me to be the person I am, the artist I am, and they're paying me. And you know, there's also a sense of this is the real world, meaning that I've come across, and it's, I have to say, it's usually other academics who will kind of, you know, sniff at this and say, oh yeah, so you're just turning these poor hip hop artists into imperialists. And, you know, my thought is, well, first of all, I don't have that kind of power to turn, you know, hip hop artists in. Like, they do what they want. You know, yeah. It's like, don't give me the credit, which I don't want, of being able to turn these incredibly strong-willed artists into puppets of the U.S. government. But then there's also the kind of the blinders that those of us, and I include myself, who enjoy a certain privilege in life, to be able to criticize those who have to make hard decisions about who to work with, about where to take money, about what opportunities to take. And I spent a lot of time talking with hip hop artists and just listening. And I remember one conversation where a group of, and these were all men who were talking about, and they were all from different cities in the US. And what they said is, and they all agreed with each other, that it wasn't a question of whether they were going to join a gang. It was which gang would they join. Like, they simply did not have the option not to be in that life. But from a certain vantage point or a certain privileged vantage point, you could say, well, you always have a choice, and might criticize people for making these choices. And that's what I learned, is that's not the real world for a lot of artists. And of course, there are people of varying degrees of privilege within hip hop. I'm not trying to paint with a really broad brush, but the reality is, if the government is coming to you and saying, we're going to pay you, and we're going to pay you money that you might not be able to make otherwise, and you're going to get to travel as an artist, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for people to turn that down just without even thinking about it. So I would say, you know, there's a lot of sophisticated thinking that goes into this. And one thing I always appreciated was that no one went in thinking that there wasn't the possibility of being compromised or being used. It was just like, I'm going in with my eyes wide open, and I'm going to be careful, and I'm going to try to be the artist I want to be. But I do know that there's the possibility of compromise or exploitation. But the fact is, that's life, really. That's, you know, that's not different from deciding whether to take a job, you know, do a gig for Sprite or for, you know, Nike, you know, or for a school or for a, you know, an NGO or a university. So, I mean, the thing is, to be clear, I'm not trying to say the government, the U.S. government, doesn't have a very specific history of exploitation. It does. And one of the things that I always, that I have tried to do, is to educate myself about that history. So I actually can talk about any number of times that the U.S. government has overthrown other countries. You know, I could tell you about the coups in, you know, Guatemala or Iran, or, you know, assassinations in Congo, and all that. So I don't pretend that this is not part of our history. But one thing that I appreciate about the artists I work with is they say, look, if the government should be hiring me, you know, rather than doing all this stuff that I criticize them for. Finally, they're doing something good with the money and hiring me as an artist. So there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot more to say about that, but it's nuanced, and it's something that I, you know, would really want people who are not in, who are looking in from the outside, to understand that these are very sophisticated thinkers who are dealing with a world that does not allow them to just stand on the sidelines.
Yeah. And in the book, you talk a lot about like subversive complicity, like people who just like, mm-hmm. they come in, they represent where they're from, what they about, what their politics are. So I wonder on the flip side, what then was the State Department's handling of like the artists just kind of being who they are, while also, you know, being tasked with supposedly representing the U.S. government in these different contexts?
Well, it's tricky for them because, you know, we've had artists who will just say, I'm an anti-imperialist, yeah. and the U.S. is an imperialist country. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, most of the time, the reality is that we don't have people just following us around all the time, watching everything. So the reality is that if, you know, we go to a certain country and one of the artists wants to connect with people and, you know, have tea and talk about, you know, their anti-imperialist views, that happens. And I actually don't think that the people at the embassy would try to stop that. They there is a certain amount of discomfort, but I think they just have to deal with it. And there was, an occasion, I think I do mention this in the book, where one of our artists, Pinky Ring, very outspoken, amazing MC from Chicago, had a song called Revolution. And, you know, she just laid into police and to Trump and to the government. And she actually performed this at the ambassador's residence in Cambodia, you know, this. And the people from the embassy afterwards kind of gently came up and said, you know, maybe don't perform that at our public show, you know, tomorrow. And the response of the team was, no, we're going to perform it. And the world didn't end. You know, it was actually, it was fine. You had American artists criticizing their own government. And I know, you know, I'm sure that it made people feel uncomfortable at the embassy. But on the other hand, if you want proof that these aren't puppets and, you know, these hip hop artists are speaking their mind, well, having them criticize the boss, you know, the president at that time was Trump, should be, you know, pretty clear proof that the U.S. allows its citizens to criticize its government.
Yeah. And so in a way, I think you speak about this in the book somewhat, like actually building more with the people who in these contexts that may be critical of the U.S. government as well. It's like, yo, I actually feel you on that. I'm on the same page. But yeah, we've talked about a couple different forms of internal conflict or conflict with the messaging of different artists versus like the goals of the State Department. And in chapter two, you say, in seeking to transform conflict, you were also courting it. And it makes me think of, I don't know if you remember that Dave Chappelle sketch, like Keeping It Real Goes Wrong, like what if they get into these like kind of comical conflicts because, you know, they're just representing it and then it goes poorly. So I wondered if you could unpack what that means a little bit, courting conflict in these contexts, as well as if you could speak some about the idea of conflict transformation.
Yeah, thanks. So I'll start with conflict transformation. So that's a less common term than conflict resolution. But the idea is that instead of resolving a beef between two groups, it's a more general term for transforming conflict, meaning harnessing conflict, which is in our lives and is inescapable. We actually recognize that conflict is part of life and is not something that can be avoided. So really the question is not how do you avoid conflict, but how do you transform that energy into something positive? So, and art is a great way to do that. I mean, anyone who knows the history of hip hop knows that it transforms conflict into rhyme, into dance, into beats, into graffiti, into writing, and so on. So that's the idea behind conflict transformation, that we're not going in there trying to break up fights because you have to know the history. You have to know the history much more than we can and the culture in order to mediate a conflict. And we're not sent in as mediators. And that gets the idea of courting conflict, because if you think about it, let's say, you know, you see two people arguing just on the street and you go in and you say, hey, you know, can't you two get along?
Yeah.
They're like, who are you? Yeah, get out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like who, like what the hell do you know? And that's just like someone in your own culture. It could be someone in your own family. Now imagine going to another country, representing the U.S. government and trying to step in the middle of some, could be generations or centuries long conflict and saying, okay, here's what you're going to do.
Everybody calm down. It's like, no, man, you don't know what's been going on out here for like, yeah, it could be centuries.
Exactly. So it actually, to do that is to show the worst kind of ugly American, caricature, which is that we're arrogant, that we go into situations that we without knowing what we're doing. So we try to avoid that. We try to go in asking questions. We listen. We show respect. We try to learn as much as we can, and we try to respect people by avoiding trying to solve their problems for them, but instead using hip hop as a means to develop tools that they could use to express themselves. And so even then, I should say, we could still be creating problems that we don't know about. I mean, our mere existence can create problems, because I've seen this happen. We come in and, I mean, it's pretty easy to understand when you step back and think about it. But let's say somebody from another country comes in and into your community and says, I'm going to teach your students how to do what you teach them. And, you know, people might say, well, I'm not sure that I want you doing that. And that has happened even before we say anything. Our mere existence can create conflict. So we have to go in, and I've seen this over and over again, and kind of show our intent, demonstrate our respect. So, you know, I've had conversations where people kind of stand there with their arms crossed, kind of staring at us, and over the course of a couple hours, we'll kind of relax, like, okay, we get it, we understand why you're here. So that's one reason why we always take an advance trip before the residency. So a couple of people, the manager of the residency and someone else, sometimes just the manager, but we'll go and meet with a bunch of people before anything else happens and just get to know them. So that paves the way for a smoother residency. And that is really crucial, because just showing up on day one and saying, you know, snapping your fingers and saying, okay, here's how it's going to be done, is not the way to create mutual respect and understanding. Mutual understanding is the language that State Department uses, and it's not the way to build with people.
You talked a little bit about some potential like barriers you would encounter upon entering new contexts, but then also ways of transcending them. Were there any limitations to hip-hop diplomacy that you felt like, well, this is just the line for this work?
Well, there are always cultural differences that, you know, when it comes down to it, it's better just to be respectful and not go there. So, for example, we went to Jordan, and, you know, Israel is, just saying the word Israel, the name Israel in Jordan, it's almost like a fighting word. Even if you're not saying anything positive about Israel, yeah. You know, and I learned that, I learned that the hard way. I didn't say anything positive about Israel. I just said, I made like some parenthetical remark about how, Israel was a neighbor and I was talking about conflict and say, you might have conflict with neighbors. And just saying that name was enough to get people really riled up and upset with me. And I was like, whoa, I didn't,
Damn, yeah.
And it's like, okay, I should not have gone there. And there was nothing that good intentions would have helped in that situation. So what I learned, sometimes you just have to shut up and really, this is a kind of truism, but it reminds me, you got to stick to what you know. And if you don't know what you're talking about, don't talk. And that actually is hard to do. And I will say it's hard for Americans to do, because we're told that we're exceptional, that we're the greatest country in the world, and we have to actually push against that kind of indoctrination that we've experienced and come in with humility and realize that there's a lot we don't know.
I want to thank you again so much for taking the time out to chat with me. The book is called Build, The Power of Hip-Hop Diplomacy in a Divided World. Tons of fascinating stories of hip-hop artists in different countries, different hijinks, and different lessons about the power of hip-hop diplomacy as well as its limitations. So I recommend y'all check it out. And Dr. Katz, thanks again for your time.
Well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
All right, and that was the interview. You know, listening to stuff like that, I always love it because it makes me feel like a certain amount of pride in being a hip-hopper or hip-hop head or hip-hop artist or just involved with, like, hip-hop culture, because it's just like, you know, you can literally use hip-hop for anything, you know? We've mentioned before using it as a tool in education, using it in politics. It's beautiful shit. Beautiful shit. But that's what we got for this week. Next week, I don't want to give any false advertisements, but I think Mariah may be back next week. If she isn't, it's going to be like the last week that she's gone. Pretty sure. But I will see you guys next week, and I'm going to close this off like we close off every episode, with a little bit of rapping. Hey, yo, you know what? We ain't even got to get a new beat, yo. Hey, Joel, just turn this shit up. Let me go in. Yeah, 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 yeah. Now hip hop, a hip it to the dope, knife popping. It don't stop the rock until the rhyme stop dropping. And I'm caught by the cops and they lock me till I'm back on the street. Now thank y'all for tuning in to Waiting to Reparate. Love y'all so much, hope that we never separate. Give a like, a comment, maybe an extra play. Now it's time that I be out, y'all have the best of day. Hey, hey, hey. You are rocking with Dope Knife, the rap wizard. And you are listening to Waiting on Reparations. See y'all next week.
Waiting on Reparations is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.